2. A miscue. There are establishments in which you suddenly come across a dull red lamp over a door marked Staff Only. Or, more recently, it may be an imposing plate glass sign. Strictly no entrance for unauthorized persons. There may even be a grim security guard sitting at a little table and inspecting passes. As always, when confronted with the forbidden, your imagination runs away with you. In reality, the door opens onto another unremarkable corridor, perhaps a bit cleaner. A strip of cheap red carpet, standard government issue, runs down the middle. The parquet floor has been more or less polished. Spittoons are stationed at fairly frequent intervals. But there are no people. There is no movement out of one door and into another. And these doors are all covered with black leather stuffed with padding, pinned down by white studs, and bearing shiny oval number plates. Even those who work in one such room know less about what goes on in the room next door than they do about the day's gossip on the island of Madagascar. On the same gloomy, frost-free December evening, in the building of the Moscow Central Automatic Telephone Exchange, on one of those forbidden corridors, and in one of those inaccessible rooms, known to the superintendent of the building as Room 194, and to Department 11 of the 6th Administration of the Ministry of State Security as Post A1, two lieutenants were on duty. Not in uniform, however. They could enter and leave the telephone exchange with greater anonymity in civilian dress. One wall was occupied by a switchboard and acoustic apparatus, black plastic and shiny metal. A long schedule of instructions, on dingy paper, hung on the other. These instructions anticipated and warned against every imaginable breach of or departure from routine in monitoring and recording calls to and from the U.S. Embassy, stipulating that two persons should be on duty at all times, one listening in continuously, never removing the earphones, while the other should never leave the room except to go to the bathroom, and that they should alternate duties at half-hour intervals. If you followed these instructions, mistakes were impossible. But such is the fatal incompatibility of officialdom's perfectionism with man's pitiful imperfection that these instructions had for once been disobeyed. Not because the men on duty were novices, but because they were experienced enough to know that nothing special ever happened, least of all on the Western Christmas Eve. One of them, the flat-nosed Lieutenant Tukin, was certain to be asked in next Monday's politics class, "Who are the friends of the people? And how do they fight against the Social Democrats? Why we had to break with the Mensheviks at the Second Congress and had been right to do so? Why we had reunited at the Fifth Congress, again acting correctly? Then at the Sixth Congress had again gone our separate ways and yet again had been right to do so." Tukin wouldn't have dreamed of starting his reading on Saturday, with little hope of memorizing anything then. Except that after duty on Sunday, he and his sister's husband intended to do some serious drinking. He would never be able to take in any of that crap with a hangover on Monday morning, and the party organizer had already rebuked him and threatened to bring him before the party bureau. The important thing was not answering in class, but being able to present a written summary. Tukin hadn't been able to find time all that week, and had been putting it off all day. But now he had asked his colleague to keep working for a while, made himself comfortable in the corner by the light of a desk lamp, and started copying into his exercise notebook selected passages from the short course. Short course, the history of the All-Union Communist Party, Bolsheviks, short course. The Central Catechism under Stalin, required reading for all Soviet citizens from 1938 to 1956, allegedly authored by Stalin. They hadn't yet gotten around to switching on the overhead light. The auxiliary lamp by the tape recorders was on. Kuleshov, the curly-haired lieutenant with the chubby chin, sat with his earphones on, feeling bored. The embassy had phoned in its shopping orders in the morning, and from lunchtime onward seemed to have fallen asleep. There hadn't been a single call. After sitting like this for some time, Kuleshov decided to take a look at the sores on his left leg. They kept breaking out again and again for unknown reasons. They had been dressed with brilliant green zinc ointment and a streptocidal preparation, but instead of healing, the sores had spread under the scabs. The pain had begun to make walking uncomfortable. The MGB clinic had made an appointment for him with a professor. Kuleshov had recently been given a new flat, and his wife was expecting a child. And now these ulcers were poisoning what should have become a comfortable life. Kuleshov removed the tight earphones, which pressed on his ears, moved to a brighter spot, rolled up the left leg of his trousers and his long underwear, and began cautiously feeling and picking at the edges of the scabs. Dark pus oozed out under the pressure of his fingers. The pain made his head spin and blotted out all other thoughts. For the first time, the thought shot through his mind that perhaps these were not just sores, but... He tried to remember a terrible word he had heard somewhere. Gangrene? And what was that other thing? So he did not immediately notice the bobbins start noiselessly spinning as the tape recorder automatically switched itself on. Without taking his bare leg from its support, Kuleshov reached for the earphones, put one ear to them, and heard, "How do I know you're speaking the truth? Do you know what a risk I'm taking? The atomic bomb? But who are you? Tell me your name." The atomic bomb. Obeying an impulse as instinctive as that of a man who grabs the nearest object to break his fall, Kuleshov tore the plug from the switchboard, disconnecting the two telephones, and only then realizing that, contrary to instructions, he had not intercepted the caller's number. The first thing he did was look over his shoulder. Tukin was scribbling his summary and had eyes for nothing else. Tukin was a friend, but Kuleshov had been warned to keep an eye on him, which meant that Tukin had received similar instructions. As he turned the rewind knob of the recorder and plugged the spare recorder into the embassy loop, Kuleshov thought at first of erasing the recorded message to conceal his blunder. But he remembered at once that his chief had often said that the work of their post was duplicated by automatic recording in another place, and he dropped that silly idea. Of course the recording was duplicated, and for suppressing a conversation like that you'd be shot. The tape had rewound itself. He turned the play knob. The criminal was in a great hurry and very agitated. Where could he have been speaking from? Obviously not from a private apartment, and hardly from his place of work. It was always from public phone booths that people tried to get through to embassies. Opening his directory of phone booth numbers, Kuleshov hurriedly dialed a telephone located on the steps of the entrance to the Sokolniki metro station.
"Genka! Genka!" he croaked. "Emergency! Call the operations room. They may still be able to catch him."